Welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Rader.
And today we are joined by the one and only Sasha Sagan. Sasha, great to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm very excited to read your new book that is about to come out. I haven't dived into it yet. I know Andrew has been.
Yeah, very good book. Highly recommended.
I feel a little bit in the dark going into this because I haven't read it, but Andrew's told me, you know, what it's about, and I'm very intrigued to read it because, for a number of reasons, which we'll get into. But at first, I should set you up. You're an author. Is this your first book?
This is my first book. I'm really excited.
Okay.
Maybe too excited.
I think it's great. And you have a degree in dramatic literature. Is that right?
Yes, I do. And I kind of use it in a way in what I do, but not as directly as maybe I thought I was going to.
Maybe not so dramatically.
Yes, exactly. Literature, yes. I try to play it a little cool, not be too dramatic.
Right. So where did you study?
I went to NYU, which was lots of fun. I grew up in Ithaca in upstate New York, and people always say, "Oh, you're from Ithaca. Why didn't you go to Cornell?" I'm from Ithaca, and I love Ithaca, and I have like my same best friends that I grew up with. My husband's from Ithaca too. I have a lot of hometown pride, but I was like very eager to get to New York City as urgently as possible.
Right. And you're in Boston now, right?
Yes. I live in Boston now for the last about 4 and change years.
So Andrew, do you have anything you want to say up top about the book since you're the only one that has had a chance to read it? I don't have a physical copy.
Well,
so
I assume that Sasha read it as well a few times.
Yes.
I mean, in fact, I know she did because she did the audiobook, which I'd like to hear a lot about because you were saying that audiobook recording is a lot more difficult than you expected.
Yes. Well,
what was that experience like? Did you find yourself having to... or thinking you were overly dramatizing things, or did you try to play it cool? Were you thinking about it too much, overthinking it?
Oh my God, no, I was trying to tone down I cry. It makes me sound really unstable. But I cried so much reading it, and it was really hard just like in a practical sense, because you know when you like fill in like a preposition or something like that when you're reading something out loud, let's say like at school or, you know, whatever, when you have to read something that's written, but it's like, it has to be exactly verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. You know, you write a book over the course of a couple years and you change things and your brain just unwittingly puts in like a the instead of an A or, you know, something like that. And so that was really hard. And then a lot of the book is about celebrations and rituals around the world and throughout history, which was great when I was just reading the names of these ancient things and typing those words into a document. But then when I had to say them aloud, I suddenly was like, oh my goodness, this is a lot of like, you know, Aztec words that I don't have.
Pushlipochli.
Yes, exactly.
Quetzalcoatl.
Exactly. I put on my Instagram story, like on walking to the recording studio, like repeating them to myself. And I hope I did okay with those. But those two things were hard in a just practical sense. But it was really hard emotionally because, you know, a lot of the book is really personal. And I talk about my dad, who I lost when I was 14. And I talk about other people who I've loved who are no longer here. And also I found, maybe I was just really emotional in general, but I found that like a lot of the stuff that really got me was the historical stuff. And, you know, we sort of feel emotionally divorced when we like learn about, you know, battles and invasions and horrible things that happened throughout history where whole, you know, where cultures were obliterated, and it's sort of abstract when we learn about it. But there was something about reading some of these things out loud that all of a sudden it struck me so deeply that these were people who other people grieved for and missed and lost. And so that stuff made me really, I was like, there are a lot of ups and downs, guys. It was really
this is starting to sound strangely dramatic.
Yeah, totally. But the woman who directed me in it, because you get a director, which is amazing, when you do an audiobook, which is great because I'm not an actor, so I needed some guidance here, you know. And she said, oh, yeah, people always cry, even if it's not their book, even if the book's not even sad or has anything to do with anything. People just always cry. And I took that to be
Andrew, did you cry on your audiobook?
I never cried. In fact, there were sad parts, and I tried to have a somber tone, but sometimes it's hard, you know, to do that. So you're trying to feel the emotions as you go through it. I had the same experiences with the difficult words. In fact, like Aztec words, it's like my book is largely history. So I had the exact same thing. I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know how to pronounce like the ancient Persian emperor's names and all this kind of stuff.
Andrew is emotional.
Ready?
He doesn't have to cry.
Okay. Yeah, a little bit. Oh, I mean, I do have emotions, but like a Vulcan, I suppress them.
So. Okay. Well, like I, on the other end of the spectrum, cry at every Ancestry.com commercial that comes on television. So between the two of us, we probably, like, there could be like a normal, healthy approach to feeling.
That's amazing. So your book, Sasha, is for creatures, for small creatures such as we, rituals for finding meaning in our unlikely world. And I'm wondering, like, you know, as somebody who grew up with a lot of rituals that I don't really hold to anymore, I'm fascinated by this approach to this book, and I'm curious what your interest was in this topic.
So, well, thank you. So I, you know, I'm secular. I'm not religious. And my dad was a scientist. My parents together wrote lots of books and essays about beauty and grandeur of science. And I think that, but on the other end of it, we're also Jewish. And like, I really think of myself as Jewish, even though I don't subscribe to any of the religious elements, but science and, you know, sort of secular humanism or whatever you want to call it, secular culture, you know, is missing like recipes and expressions and holidays. And, you know, those of us who are not devoutly religious, we still have to mark time. We still have weddings. We still have funerals. We still have, you know, kids come of age, and we still have to do something to sort of offset the whole darkness of winter and be together and have community. And I guess I just began really becoming curious about how we do that without the infrastructure of religion, which has historically often been the source of this sort of, you know, timing and prescription for how to handle these changes, right? Because that's really what it's about, processing changes. Either it's, you know, something as permanent as like a death, you know, where we process it partly through some, you know, ritual to do with a funeral or some grieving ritual, or just like the change of like, it's fall now. It was summer. Remember when it was summer? That seemed like it was just summer. And now it's fall. Like, what do we do with this? And so I don't know, as I sort of was reading and researching and learning, it just seemed so clear to me that underneath, you know, the specifics of like, you know, theological or cultural, you know, the specifics of the stories that we tell, underneath, we're all sort of celebrating the same thing. And the holidays that we have concocted around the world all sort of fall at the same time. And what we're really celebrating are actually scientific events, biological changes, astronomical changes. And so, you know, if you're really devout, you already have all that stuff. But if you're not, I think there's a way to kind of still find the beauty and celebration in life without necessarily being locked into something that you no longer subscribe to.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting hearing you talk about that from a Jewish perspective. And I'm wondering if that's a difficult position for you with any of your family, or is any of your family still devoutly religious or?
No.
No?
Definitely not.
That's good.
I would say, yeah, no, I mean, in my book, I write about like my great grandparents were Orthodox.
Right.
And my grandfather sort of parted ways with their level of devoutness and their rituals, but he still saw himself as Jewish. And there's really not any, I have people in my life who are religious of all, you know, of many, not all, I should say, many different religions. And, but I don't have anybody I can think of in my family who I would say is devoutly Jewish or who would object to my perspective. And I think a lot of times people are just like really happy that there are elements that you want to carry on, you know, because like, so my husband's not Jewish and we have the same philosophical perspective, but we both, you know, bring different traditions to our daughter and like, but we have a secular Passover Seder. It just doesn't involve God, but we do these things. And I think that a lot of times it's really easy to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And if you reject the theological elements to just say, well, we're done with the whole thing. And I think maybe because I didn't grow up religious, so I didn't reject it. I just, you know, I just, there's elements of it I really love. And I think there's a way to sort of celebrate those without necessarily being shackled by the stuff that you don't, you just don't agree with.
Yeah, I ask because, you know, I did grow up religious and I'm not anymore. And
where did you grow up? What religion? I don't know. Tell me.
Southern Baptist. Its own religion. I haven't been religious in many years.
Your parents are preachers, actually. My parents are preachers.
Yes. Yeah. My family is actually not in my life right now.
And I'm sorry.
It's been a couple years.
That's
yeah.
Tough.
So
yeah.
But yeah, that's why I ask is because that's this particular part of like this recontextualization of my own rituals has been, you know, a really difficult, personal journey, you know, and I've found, and that's why I'm so excited to read your book, that the ritual is really the most important thing. It really is what's at the root of all these practices that people of all walks of life, you know, participate in. And I think the way you put it earlier is so beautiful. It's not that, you know, for a long time, most of our rituals were rooted in religion, but now that we're in this like interconnected world where like, you know, we can share ideas with people in an instant on the other side of the planet. Like so many rituals are kind of, being forced to evolve. And I think that this book is so timely because of that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I hope so. I think that's the thing too, is, you know, no matter what, it's like, I don't know. I don't think you can replace something with nothing. You know, I think that it's really hard. I mean, right. You're still going to have that. You're still going to be drawn to mark time and mark these transitions. And it's like, you can't throw it all out. So how do you navigate this? And I think the more that we study religions and cultures, even from a secular perspective, the more you realize that we're all really, even cultures totally independently of each other who had no way of communicating, we're still coming to the same ideas about what was worthy of celebration.
Right.
Yeah, just on the separation of cultural ritual from supernatural elements of religion, I think your approach is really sort of grassroots and people celebrating the things that come naturally to them or in their past or their history or whatever they find meaningful for themselves. It's really grassroots. But I've often wondered about, you know, the religious structure and whether that provides some kind of community and things like that. My mother goes to church, but I don't think she's really religious, but she does it because she has family and friends and she considers it to be sort of a network. And I've often wondered if it's possible to have like a secular religion or something like that, where you go to church to listen to science lectures.
Yes.
Do you think is that possible or does it attract, you know,
does the supernatural element provide a glue?
Yeah. Well, why hasn't it taken off? Interesting. Because I think atheists tend to be free thinkers, so they don't want to be involved in any kind of organization. So they're all just going off
in their own.
Right,
I don't want to be a member of any club that would have me as a member. Right.
They reject the community and the organization at the same time as the supernatural.
Okay. Well, so this is a very interesting question. For one, I do think that there are secular, you know, congregations popping up. They do exist. I mean, the rabbi who married us was a secular rabbi who had a secular congregation of secular Jews in New York. And like, there's like Sunday Assembly, which I don't know a ton about, but is like a secular Sunday in the style of a church service. But as I understand it, not having been, I'd like to go. But sort of more like lectures and things like that. The thing is, when you make something, or like when you invent something new, it's so hard for it to not feel like a little bit contrived, you know? It kind of would work better if like an existing religious congregation, if an existing religious congregation got together and was like, you know what? I'm a little skeptical about this. Mm. Are you a little skeptical about this? And they all decided to transition into something else, but they already had those like bonds of, community and friendship, because it's all. But then again, on the other hand, I met a woman the other day here in Boston, and she, whenever you get into a conversation, what do you do? Anyways, my book came up, and I was telling her about it, and she was like, well, I'm in a running club, and we have the same interests. And then she sort of corrected herself and said obsession. But we also, so we get together and run once a week, but we also do like charitable stuff together. And the more she was describing it, I was like, this is like a congregation, but it's just centered around exercise, you know? And I mean, that's just a anecdotal evidence, but that's something that really struck me. I think we do this in a certain way, your group of friends, or you have whatever, everyone goes to somebody's house for Sunday night dinner or whatever it is. I think that these things sort of happen organically and we don't even realize, but the problem is it's also because it's not organized in a, like, in a way where it's like, well, we have to be here. It's also easy for it to sort of fall away. And so I write in the book, one of the things that I think is most wonderful about religious society is the social pressure to do good works and to do, you know, and like, you know, and it's like, I don't know, I guess, I think that that would have to be an element of a secular congregation or a secular, whatever the equivalent is here, there would have to be a purpose. You don't just get together to talk and think, which is great. And I love talking and thinking. I don't want to at all discourage that. But I think that there would have to be an element of action as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I've always thought that that religion is kind of it's more than, a lot of people say it's just like social cohesion, like a way to keep people like thinking the same way and stuff. But I think it's more than that. And I think this ritual idea kind of, cracks that open. And I think it's like, you know, there's something really mammalian about community. And I think that it's no mistake or it's no accident that this ritual of coming together every week or whatever is the foundation of society, arguably, you know, like it's, if you look at the earliest civilizations, they all had some kind of, weekly gathering or, you know, meeting or something. And I think it's because it brings people together.
Right. And we have evolved to live in little tribes, and now we're in a 7 billion person tribe. And it's like hard to set up like meetings, you know? We have to like figure out a way. And that's the thing too, is we're in this transition where we're all, because of technology, we're all able to be together in this way that we never were before. And we have to figure out what that means for us and how we're gonna feel connected to one another, even if, you know, someone you never meet in person. And I think, and at the same time, it's so much easier to go really, you know, to not spend as much time with other people if you have your phone and you have your computer and you have the sort of illusion that you're with a group, but you're by yourself physically.
Yeah. The illusion of community.
Right. And I don't, not to say that a community online isn't a community, but it's not the same. It just is it's a variation on the theme of like, you know, a couple of dozen people coming together once a week and singing or, you know, or praying or doing these things that are, you know, people would do in one physical place together.
Yeah. But these rituals seem like it's more than just like the marking of time. It's like, I think that there is something inside of us that wants that community, at least to a certain level, you know, I think like everybody responds to that and can benefit from it.
Yeah. And I think that it's, there's something, I mean, if you are secular and you think like, this is it, or we don't know if there's anything else, but let's just for argument's sake, say it's just, we're here for the blink of an eye on a little out of the way planet. And, you know, there's a long time before we are born, and then we're here for a second, and then we go, and we don't know where that is, but it maybe is nowhere. And, well, then what do we have? And it's like, well, we have one another, and the idea that we're here right now. And I think that's really powerful. And I think that it, like coming together in that way, especially to do something good, is a really important way of feeling that, you know, we're here right now, we're in it together.
Yeah. And I think what I'm trying to get at is that, I think the reason we need that is because we're mammals, you know, like reptiles don't need that, you know, like they just eat each other, you know?
Correct. Correct. I do not. Right. That's why, you know, you see so few reptiles at church. It's just like,
I don't know. I'm pretty sure I've seen several.
No, but you know what I mean?
Like lizard people.
It's so true. It is mammalian. It is very mammalian. And it's a survival mechanism. Yeah. It's not just that we like it, it's that we need it.
Yeah, and that's the part that's been really tricky for me, you know, because I grew up in church for the first like 20 years of my life. And now that I don't go, you know, just figuring out like, well, this exact question we're talking about now, like, is there a church where people just talk about facts and science and philosophical ideas and just like don't really sweat the small stuff? Like, is that possible or is it even worth it? Like, all these thoughts have been like, you know, plaguing me for a long time. Yeah. And I think it's so interesting. And I think there are some options. Like, I think there's, you know, there's like Unitarian churches and stuff like that, but I think it's all basically, it's all basically like modeled after Western religion.
But every religious movement is modeled after the guys who were like 5 minutes earlier. You know what I mean? Nothing is not like, you know, it's like, you can't, it would be impossible, I think, or it would be, let's put it this way, less successful to take something like, you know, start from total scratch. This is a very popular, useful way of doing things. And any new version of a secular congregation has to take from what the people who would go grew up with, because it's just, then it's more familiar and comfortable. And because there's value in that idea, we don't have to totally like throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know, to create something that's so dramatically different. It's there's a value and beauty in that. And if we just, and that's kind of like a lot of the rituals that I talk about, it's like, well, if you can kind of take the part you love and really emphasize that and let some of the other stuff fall away, you can, I think, get some fulfillment.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It's hard to say if religion might sort of gradually turn that way. I know my mother's church, which is basically secular, like her minister says, oh, the Bible's just stories, and they have like gay ministers and all that kind of stuff. And like, I'm pretty sure that most people don't really believe if you put them on the spot. But I don't know, because they're losing people, they're losing attendance, and the church is basically going to fall apart. And I think that's maybe going to happen. I mean, there are definitely secular rituals you talk about, like even sports, all these people getting together and watching the same thing at the same time.
Yeah.
Or date nights or the alphabet song.
Right, exactly. I mean, sports is a huge one, and people really invested, and that's also so ancient and like tribal.
Except we used to actually kill each other.
Right, exactly. So this is a step forward, but it's
way less exciting now.
Across the field, stakes are a little lower, but you wouldn't know it in some bars.
That's true.
But it's so true. Sorry, go ahead, Andrew.
No, but still, I mean, that's not really the same thing, because as you say, like, sports did live alongside religion, right? And religion, I think kind of the purpose of religion is to explain the unexplained. And the hardest thing people can deal with is uncertainty. Yeah. That humans have so much trouble dealing with uncertainty, more than bad news or anything like that. So religion, I think, was created to answer questions that we didn't have answers to. And most of those are supernatural questions or you know, big questions that, you know, even some of them we still don't know, like what is death and, you know, where did the universe come from and stuff like that. And religion provides answers when we don't have them. Right. And so I just don't know if there's kind of, if it's going to morph into a secular version.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I don't think it's going to morph. I mean, religiosity ebbs and flows with people's needs. And I don't think that it's going to be like, okay, well, we're all done with that. But I think that there's another element. I mean, yes, explaining the inexplicable is a huge part of it. But there's another element too, which is a sort of like celebration of miracles and gratitude. That is also part of it. And like, I really think that that is something that can make the leap into a sort of secular version of itself is the idea of miracles in a, you know, for lack of a better word, but the secular idea of like, this is so amazing that we're here at all at this moment. And I think that there's something to be said for that, that actually people can really, you know, you could imagine people like giving testimony about that and really working to together. I mean, this is the thing that, and I write a little bit about this, but it's like, if you don't think that there is, you know, a grand plan and you don't think that there is a system of justice that, you know, a god or gods is orchestrating where like the bad guys will get their comeuppance and the innocent good people who have had a really hard time of it will get their reward. If you don't think that there is that safety net, that moral safety net in the universe, then I think it's you have to actually work to make the world more just, that's politically or volunteering or, you know, making a donation or protesting or whatever. And some of those things, like protesting and volunteering, like that does create a community and people who are working together for a common good. And I think that is a place in which a secular community could sort of naturally take hold. And, you know, and even if that sort of replaces the element of like, well, we have to come up with a explanation for what we can't understand. Although, and I agree with you that that's one of the hardest things for human beings. And I talk about in the book a little bit, the idea of tolerating ambiguity and like so just important. Sitting with the discomfort of like, I don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's horrible. I mean, everybody struggles with it sometimes, whether it's like a, you know, existential crisis level, you know, or a, you know, whatever your word, waiting for like the person you like to text you back or whatever it is. But it's like that discomfort with like, I don't know what's going to happen is palpable and painful and debilitating. And it's no surprise that we've come up with ways to try to avoid sitting there with that. And I think you're right. I think that that's part of what religion can offer.
Yeah, this one's interesting to me because, you know, there's a, as somebody who grew up in the church, there's a biblical reference that I think it's somewhere in Matthew, in the book of Matthew. It says something about, it's talking about like the way of life and finding it. And it describes that way as a narrow road and that only a few find it. And I think that what's interesting about that is it seems like strangely Darwinian. It's like, you know, it's like, it could almost be talking about natural selection in a way, you know, but at the same time, this uncertainty thing that we keep coming back to, I think is a huge piece because, of religion, I mean, because it seems like the further we go and the more we learn and the more we're able to define scientifically, the smaller and smaller the domain of religion becomes because there's fewer mysteries, you know? And so over the years, the Christian church anyways, has had to recontextualize so many beliefs about what this world is and stuff, you know, it's, you know, even like back in, I mean, the countless times throughout history from like quantum mechanics and the uncertainty principle and like all kinds of stuff that the church has had to rethink their approach to.
Sure. The layout of the solar system. Sure.
Yeah, geocentricity. right. So I think it's I think that this uncertainty thing is something that is really tough for humans. And I think maybe it's because we're cognitive and we're self-aware and we wrestle with that. And it's a struggle to be self-aware.
We just ask adults for answers. Yeah. And they know the answer to everything.
Right.
But now when we're adults, we realize, oh, they don't know the answer.
That depends. I mean, yes. And I think that one of the most powerful things you can say to your kid when they ask you a question is, I don't know. And like for me, my parents, if I could ask a question to which they didn't know the answer, they were delighted. And that was really wonderful for me because it was such a reveal that like there is no single authority. But in terms of all the things that have gone from the religious column to the scientific column and all the things that, mental illness even is like, people, imagine how many people with schizophrenia were seen as being possessed or, things like that over the eons. I think the thing about the really like beautiful stuff, like where we are in the universe, or like, how many natural disasters, earthquakes, volcanoes, people thought it was punishment. And now to understand like, tectonic plates. The problem, I think what sometimes happens when things move from the religious column to the scientific column is we lose the sense of awe. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been such a loss.
That's so true.
Because when we understand them, then it gets like, we have this negative association with facts that get like maligned as like cold and hard and but like to understand something more deeply is to honor it. And I think it's a way of appreciating it and having awe and wonder for it, even the really scary things like volcanoes. Especially the volcanoes. I want to focus on volcanoes. No. but all of this stuff, that used to be there would be a religious or supernatural explanation. I just think once, if we can get back to the place where there's still a sense of like awe in the, when we look at like the majesty of the planet or where we are in, in the universe, but still understand how like the physics work, that would be a really great place to be as a society.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise.
I wonder if there's a difference between awe and reverence, because I used to go to church. I used to be a little bit religious, but I definitely observed lots of religious people. And it seemed to me that there's definitely like a reverence, like people sort of say, oh, well, God did that or God created it. And isn't that wonderful sort of thing? But I don't know that I ever got a sense of awe, like looking at the stars or something like that. Maybe some religious people do get awe from religion, but it seems to me that's almost separable from reverence, which is saying, oh, we're so grateful for the creation rather than saying, isn't this wonderful or something like that.
I would settle for reverence. It's fine.
Well, that's the one thing totally we shouldn't fine. Do as skeptical scientists or whatever. We shouldn't hold reverence. We should, be like, this is the way it is. It's just amazing. It's mind blowing, But
yeah.
Reverence is kind of like saying we owe something for it. I mean, I guess like you can be grateful, but that's different from.
I just think of it as like you revere it,
Well, I think we owe it. I think we do owe it a lot. I mean, look at climate change.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and just the feeling of like to revere something. I mean, I don't know, like the asteroid that like wiped out the dinosaurs. Like if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here, and it could have gone a million different ways, and there could have been other asteroids later, and we wouldn't be here, and all these things could have gone terribly differently, and we wouldn't be here right now doing this podcast. But here we are. And I think to have a kind of sense of, either one, reverence or awe, about the idea that, like, in all this chaos, if there's not a grand plan, then it's just astonishing that anything is happening. I mean, which is a really, like, would be a really kooky way to go through life. Like, just, like, at every moment being astonished that you're at the grocery store. But I think a little bit or whatever, you know.
Well, I mean, there's fruits, vegetables. They're kind of amazing.
Yeah, that would be one place worth being amazed, I guess.
Yes. No, you're right.
All this life, bountiful harvest.
And all right, and all these fruits at the wrong time of year. I mean, that's really amazing.
I actually say that to my kids, and they look at, like, I'll be like, isn't it amazing we didn't have to do anything for this food? It just came to us. Somebody brought it to our door. And they look at me like, you're crazy. You know, like.
Must have been
I think that's so great. Yeah, no, I mean, just like a strawberry in January, just like, what?
Yeah.
All that stuff, I think, is, I don't know, I just think more of that sort of astonishment. I mean, without sounding like totally naive all the time, but like the kind of appreciation coupled with joy about so many of these amazing things that are a byproduct of science and technology often. I mean, you know, the idea that we are in different places right now, but we are talking is amazing. And we can see each other, except for you, Andrew. But Julian and I can see each other. I mean, that's like totally, even 100 years ago, the stuff of just, you know, mythology.
Yeah. You said earlier that your parents had a great way of dealing with uncertainty, and I'm wondering if you want to talk about what it was like having Carl Sagan for a dad, or if you want to avoid that. Or
yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about it.
I mean, I'm curious.
It was great. He was a wonderful guy and a wonderful dad, and he and my mom, Andrienne, you know, wrote together, and they made the original Cosmos series together.
Right.
And they,
which is amazing.
Yes, which is amazing. I agree.
The new one's okay. It's okay.
Well, she writes and produces that one too. But the original is to me so special, and I write about this in the book too. Is like I feel so grateful that even though I lost my dad when I was 14, I have 13 hours of him talking and talking about the things that were really important to him, and I feel just like so grateful that I have that. So I love that original series with all my heart. Anyways, so talking about uncertainty, one of the stories I tell in the book is the other adult in our household besides my parents was Maruha Farhe. She was my nanny, and she came to live with us when I was 6 weeks old, and she lived with us till I was 8 and came back many summers after that. And you know, we really loved each other, and she's a really important part of my life. And she was devout Catholic, and she didn't drive, so my mom and I would take her to church every Sunday and pick her up. And her priest at her church, Father Tony, would come to dinner sometimes. Sometimes she would take me to church. I write about this in the book, and her story is amazing, which I won't get into right now, but amazing, amazing story. But when I was like a kid, I went to my parents and I said, you know, Maruha says that when you die, you're with God and with angels in heaven. And you guys say it's like you're asleep forever without dreaming. Like who pray tell is right. And they just in unison together, so joyfully said, nobody knows.
Yeah.
And like that was just so powerful to me. And like, you know, I totally like I knew like all about what Maruha believed, and I knew that it was different than what my parents believed. And, you know, especially like if we were traveling, she would sometimes take me to church with her, which I loved. And like I knew all about her belief system, even though it was different than ours and certainly was not, you know, censored in any way. But the idea that there are these like grand mysteries or even very small mysteries, but in this case, these grand mysteries to which we don't know the answer. And some of them, like this one, like what happens when you die, we will all find out in time. And some mysteries, well, maybe we'll never, you know, grand scientific mysteries that we may not ever live to see that those be solved. But just the idea that there are some things we don't know, and we're just going to have to sit with that.
Yeah.
Is, I don't know, very powerful and was really helpful to me, even as a kid.
Yeah. It's crazy to me that people have such a hard time with mystery and uncertainty, because mystery is like one of the biggest entertainment genres of all time.
Yes, what a good point.
But you find out at the end.
Exactly. But you always find out
Fair
at
enough.
The end. Right, exactly.
What if the mystery book didn't tell you the answer? That would be so frustrating to people.
Oh my God, it's like Agatha Christie yeah. was just like, well, could have been the husband, might have been the butler.
but it's the drawing out of that suspense that makes the story worthwhile.
Right, but nobody like stops with like 10 pages to go and it's like,
right.
I'm good.
Like,
I'm
totally. Close this book.
Totally. Yeah. We want the resolve. Hence religion, I guess.
Right. No, but that's such an interesting point. It's like, we don't want to never hear the question. We just want to get the answer.
Yeah. Well, I think with death specifically, it's our biggest fear, maybe because we're the only species to have escaped the food chain. Maybe for a number of reasons, but I think that like this idea of afterlife is, it fixes that problem. It's like, well, if there's something else you're going to, then it really doesn't matter what happens here. So I can be okay with death here, you know, or something like that.
Right.
For sure.
Right. Oh, yeah. For sure. Right. But even if you do believe in an afterlife or in reincarnation or something else, no matter what, the thing you're living right now, the life you're living right now, will come to an end. Life somewhere, right?
You will
it's
die.
Like life in heaven, right? Or like life in another body at another time will be different. And this, I mean, that is one thing that we do all agree on is, I think, I don't know, maybe there is a school of thought that I'm not aware of, but we do all agree that whatever we're experiencing right now will come to an abrupt end. And we have to deal with that, even if you think you're going somewhere else after.
Yeah.
Whole different crowd of people up in heaven.
Yeah. Right, exactly. To make new friends.
So people who suffer social anxiety might have a problem with it.
Right, maybe they're like going to be really busy.
There's
like,
no social anxiety in heaven.
Breaking all the rules so they don't have to go. I guess you have to, either way, you're going somewhere where you're going to have to meet people.
Yeah.
I think this idea that we're going to take elements of religion and kind of make them into our society, even if we have a secular future, maybe we don't, maybe we do, maybe it will gradually change. But the thing I really like is your description of Christmas. I love Christmas. I kind of consider it to be just like a time to spend with family and holiday off work and that kind of stuff. You know, you point out that Christmas is basically an assemblage of all kinds of previous cultural traditions, mainly to do with the solstice, the mm-hmm. harvest, possibly, all these things, celebration of the sun, Sol Invictus, the Roman one, and even like mm-hmm. Mithra, the virgin birth, and stuff like that. So I think that, oh, and even Satanists love Christmas. I think that's my favorite line in the book. Even Satanists love Christmas.
Thank you.
There's a comedy song in there.
Yes, totally. Like it.
Let's make a song.
Right. Like, I feel like it's like a Lonely Island song or something like that, you know?
Yeah. I'm hearing like a country kind of like guy on a acoustic guitar or something, you know, like a southern twang.
Yeah. Sorry, Andrew, we cut you off with our pitch for our song. What were you saying?
Yeah, we're having too much fun.
And you had like a Muslim friend, a Jewish friend who lobbied their parents to have Christmas and that kind of thing. So I think you're totally right about that. And we had an episode where we talked about, is it right to lie to your kids about Santa Claus? And I think you also said that you shouldn't. But I think you're totally right.
I didn't say you should.
Well, that's actually what we decided too. We decided you shouldn't like actively dissuade your kid, but maybe like if they come home from school, hey, mommy, daddy, is Santa Claus real? You kind of like challenge them on it and say, well, what do you think? Does that make sense to you? Does this story teaching critical thinking skills at the same time as kind of not spoiling their fantasy, but not kind of super actively promoting it, that kind of thing? Try to hedge that gap. Is that what you think too, maybe?
Oh, in terms of, I mean,
Santa Claus.
Like, far be it for me to tell anybody what to do about Santa Claus. So I didn't grow up celebrating Christmas, although as I write in the book, I did lobby my mother for it one year because I felt left out. But it wasn't because we weren't religious. It was because we were Jewish. And we had Hanukkah. Like, that's the thing is, like, you could, but I just feel like it's like the not doing anything. If you live in a place where there is, I mean, of course, obviously Christmas time, Hanukkah is celebrated in the summer in the Southern Hemisphere. But if you're in a place where in December, it's really cold and dark, like the urge to like have a feast and light stuff, make stuff like have lights on them. You know what I mean? It's so powerful and it seems like innate and like almost like, how could you not? And I think people do it all sorts of ways. And Christmas especially, I mean, most people that I know, obviously I also, most people I know are not very religious, but I know a lot of people who are secular who still celebrate Christmas, which I feel, you know, like, does that shortchange the people who for them it is really a deep, like, religious holiday that is extremely meaningful to them and is the most important day of the year, or, you know, with Easter, like, is it wrong to sort of co-opt it if you're just doing it as, like, I don't know the answer to that question, but
we need a Lucifer-ness.
Yeah, exactly. Or Festivus, right? So I don't know. So we do, I mean, like with my husband's family, we do like a very secular Christmas and we do a very secular Hanukkah. And then we do something to mark the winter solstice. Not in like a, you know, I don't know why I feel like I have to defend myself here, but like not in like a new agey way, but just the idea that like this tomorrow, the days are going to start getting longer. And that is fantastic. Yeah. And there's nothing anyone can do to stop it. And it's because of this axial tilt that we have in the way that we go around our star. And it's beautiful. And it's, I know things seem like they're, you know, really dark and cold right now, but spring will return. And I just think that it doesn't, and it's nice to just sort of peel away the layers and just have the thing that is just, even if you're really religious, that's all still true. I mean, it's still amazing and it's so beautiful. And even if you think that it happened because that's how it was designed rather than, you know, accidentally, it's still fantastic. And I think there's just something in that, that like, if you can sort of re-infuse that with wonder, so it's not just like a really boring lesson on like, you know, the axial tilt and be like, this is amazing. We have seasons. They're beautiful. They change.
It makes not in California. Whole... We don't.
No, not in California. No, sorry. I didn't realize that this is all totally moot then. But I don't know. I just think that there's something to be said for that. But at the same time, it's like, well, I really also really love doing things that I think, you know, honor my ancestors and my husband's ancestors, and care, there is something that really meaningful about carrying on a tradition that, you know, people that you came from have been doing for hundreds or thousands of years. It's beautiful also.
What about tolerance of sort of the main or people celebrating something religious, even if you're of a different religion or something like that? Like, a lot of our language comes from stuff that was originally religious, like goodbye, yes, God be with you, or the names of the week being all named after gods and things like that. But, like, if I went to the Middle East, let's say, around Ramadan, I'd just be like, okay, great, this is a cool festival or whatever. Like, this is, like, a cool celebration. You don't have to necessarily believe in the religious element to kind of be okay with it. But these days there's kind of almost this battle because religious people, you know, let's stop the war on Christmas. They want it to maintain the, you know, the Jesus stuff, basically the religious stuff. And, but I think on the secular side, we really object to people celebrating Christmas at all sometimes. And I think that we should just be tolerant of people celebrating their thing and kind of be okay with this uncertainty or this spectrum of it being different things to different people, I guess.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely for letting people do their thing. I totally agree with that. And like, my message is not like, don't believe. I don't feel like that is at all what I'm not trying to convince anyone to change their philosophy or worldview at all. It's just, if you already don't believe or you have like a little nagging doubt, you can still, like, there are still things you can do that are beautiful and meaningful and special and make you feel that feeling without just going through the motions. I feel this really strongly, like, if you are devout, do your thing. Like, yeah, by all means. And I mean, what you're talking about too is like, it's really hard to like, you know, say, oh, I'm just going to pick this up because I like the sound of it, or I like how, I mean, right, learning and understanding other people's cultures is really important. But then there is a point where, you know, there is something like appropriation. And I do think that's a fine line. But then there is like, you know, things like I was saying to someone the other day, like my favorite part of Jewish culture is the hora, you know, the dance at weddings and bar mitzvahs where they put you in the chair. And they throw you out.
Yeah.
I'm like, that is like, to me, I'm like, how has that not been adopted by everyone on earth? Because I just think it's the best thing ever. And in my opinion, it's like, if you want to just start doing that, you know, go for it. But at the same time, I think there is something to be said about being really cognizant of what these rituals mean to people.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting for me personally, because I've had so many people in my life that are still religious that are, you know, have known me my entire life. And, you know, I've just tried to be open and honest about, you know, the changes I've gone through and how I see things now. And one question that I get over and over again is like, oh, well, it's actually not really much of a question. It's more of a statement. It's like, oh, well, you think this is all just an accident. And like, you think, you know, like everything, and you think you, and this is what some religious people say to me. And I'm like, well, no, that's actually not what I think at all. Like, I'm okay with the mystery. Like, I don't think anything. Like, you know, right. I think there is this place where you can give people room to think whatever they're going to think. And you know, that is up to every individual on their own to have that mindset, whether religious or irreligious. And it's a really difficult place to maintain, like to just hold that spot of just like, well, I'm going to think what I think, and I'm okay with the mystery, but I'm not going to like, you know, force anybody or like, you know, I'm not going to solicit my ideas to anybody. You know, it's a hard thing. It's a hard place. Yeah, exactly. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing.
No, it is really hard. And it is so interesting, the idea that being secular means you think you know everything. And it's like, what's so powerful about science, and what my parents really instilled in me that was so beautiful about science, is that it's not a set of facts. It's a system that has an error-correcting mechanism. And the things that we believe right now may turn out to not be true, and they'll be disproven, and then we'll let them go. And we'll have some other view of something, and we'll have more information. And so our perspective will change with more information. And when we, you know, we won't live to get all these answers, but this is a way to get closer to understanding what's really going on. And to me, it's like, it's being secular is like, it's like you said, it's the opposite. It's the same, like we have barely scratched the surface, and we're just, trying to piece this together with the little information that we've been able to gather over the last few hundred years.
Exactly. Yeah.
Kind of always had this competition with my mom of who's more humble, the religious person or the secular person. Because the religious person says, oh, you know, we didn't, we revere God who did it. Therefore we're humble because we acknowledge the, you know, the greater contribution of the God or whatever. Whereas a secular person says, well, we're more humble because we admit we don't know the answers. Right. So it's this humble humility competition.
Yeah.
And I would just add one other point for the humble secular person. We don't believe that we are, special creatures compared to the other creatures on the planet that were made in the image of the creator. We just think we happen to be at this stage in our evolutionary trajectory, and we'll be something else later if we manage not to blow ourselves up, but we're not intrinsically apart from the other creatures on our little dusty out of the way planet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As somebody who grew up religious, this is where I was stuck for years. And I got to this place where I literally, in my early 20s, you know, like I was raised very like hardcore fundamentalist, basically. And in my early 20s, I got to this place where I was like, well, what I'm learning in history doesn't really line up with what I learn in church. And so I was stuck in this place for a long time where I was like, okay, if there is a God, surely it knows that I would be here in the 21st century learning everything that I'm learning, and that, you know, that thought just liberated me so much, just like thinking, okay, well, if there is something that created me, like, it must know that I was going to be here. And there must be like, it must be okay for me to use the brain that it allegedly gave me, you know?
Yeah.
And that was kind of like a huge turning point for me. You know, it's been about 12 years ago now, but that was stuck there for years.
That's so, so interesting.
Andrew, is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
I don't have any more questions, but I did want to tell Sasha about a tradition that we had. We used to have these Cosmos drinking game parties where we'd watch the episodes of Cosmos and drink every time your dad said billions, stars, Cosmos, and a lot of other things.
That's amazing. Did you guys get totally blacked out?
sometimes, but the thing is, I tried not to drink that much because I wanted to watch the episode. I was super into the episode.
Oh, that's so nice and wholesome. I love that. No, that is a really great tradition. See, that's the thing, is I really think that people are like performing rituals all the time, and we just don't think of them that way. But when you take a little step back, you realize they really are part of our everyday life, even if you're secular.
Yeah. Yeah. Rituals
absolutely
are so important. Well, Sasha, this has been such a great chat. Thank you so much for making the time. I want to plug your book again, For Small Creatures Such as We, Rituals for Finding Meaning in Our Unlikely World. It's out February...
October 18th.
When is it out?
October.
October.
It'll be up by the time we
October
post,
22nd.
Right? Or do you want it?
Okay, good.
Yeah.
It's October 22nd, so a week from Tuesday.
Do you have anything else you want to plug before we wrap up, like your social media channel or something?
Oh, just if you follow me on Twitter and Instagram, it's my name, Sasha Sagan. That would be nice. I like that. But otherwise, yeah, just the book. And I'm so, so glad I got to do this show. This was so much fun.
Oh, you've been awesome to have on. Thank you for making the time. And if the listeners want to follow us, you can do that. I'm at Julian Was Here on Twitter. Andrew is at Mars Raider. And we do these episodes every Monday. Check out Sasha's book and have a great week, everyone.
It was a tremendous pleasure. Thanks for listening.